there, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook. Today we're talking about Autobiography of an Archive, A Scholar's Passage to India by Nicholas B. Dirt. The book is published by Columbia University Press and Permanent Black Press in India. Nicholas is the Chancellor at the University of California, Berkeley, where he's also a Professor of History and Anthropology. This book really is a wonderful collection of essays loosely arranged along the lines of the scholar's life. The chapters touch upon various themes such as empire and the politics of knowledge, as well as the experiences of archival research. It really is an illuminating and lucid and challenging read, and I had the pleasure of talking with Nick just a few minutes before. Okay, so without any further ado, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Nick to the show. Thanks a lot for your wonderful book, and thanks a lot for agreeing to come on.
It's my great pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. So usually in these podcasts, we start by asking authors to give us some biographical details about their scholarly life before turning to the book under discussion. But in your case, the book is, as I suppose listeners will have gathered from the title, is in part autobiographical or written in an autobiographical mode at times. So for the benefit of those who have not yet read the book, I was wondering if you could start by first telling us how you ended up in India and why your love for South Indian drumming determined your early career in academia.
Well, I don't know if it determined it, but it certainly played a role in propelling me to doing what I did. I write about this in the book. I do say that my book is only in a very, very vague sense autobiographical. I don't actually say very much about myself as such, but I do in reproducing here essays, although they've all been somewhat revised, published as long ago as written as long ago as 1989, that the essays here do cover a significant portion of my scholarly writing and life. But your question goes back to why indeed I focused on India. And I grew up in Connecticut outside of New Haven. My father was a professor of religious studies, but took a Fulbright grant and went to teach for a year at Madras Christian College in Tambaram, South India. I was 12 years old. I did study South Indian drumming. I didn't, unfortunately, commit to studying Tamil at the time. I'm eternally unhappy that I didn't have the prescience to do language study when my brain was still adept at picking up language. But I did get very engaged in different kinds of cultures outside of the college campus on which we were living by going into not just the city, but going into Mylapore, the area around the Kapileshwar temple, and studying twice and sometimes thrice a week with a Mridangam teacher who spoke no English at all and taught me solely through the rhythmical syllables that that constituted the base for studying, memorizing, and then playing the South Indian drum. But it was, as I say in the book, it was the case that I didn't come away either hugely. I didn't become a concert percussionist, nor did I certainly think that I was going to become a South Asianist. But I did find that India, South Asia in general, constituted a kind of counterpoint for everything I did subsequently in school and then in college, and became a way of thinking about just about every issue I was thinking about in my education, from questions having to do with what the meaning of Western civilization was, in the most general and abstract ways that were part of my liberal arts education. To thinking through the American involvement in Vietnam, which of course became another form of counterpoint for my coming of age and early education, since this was in the late 60s. So I did decide when I had an opportunity to go anywhere in the world that I chose as part of an undergraduate senior thesis project to return to Tamil Nadu. And to take up, in some sense, where I left off, and in particular take up around the question that I had known even as a 12-year-old boy was distinctive to and very fundamentally important for South India as a region, and that is the growth of both Tamil separatism and its relationship to the anti-Brahmin movement in Tamil Nadu that became so important in its subsequent political history.
Wonderful, thank you. Now let's talk maybe a little bit more about the idea of the book itself. I was wondering, what was the idea behind bringing all these different text together in one publication. And second sort of sub question from that is, when you brought them all together, did anything new emerge for you now as a reader of your text that you published over many years?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So, you know, this is the outgrowth in part of being at a stage of my career and doing the kinds of things that I'm doing in my day job that have made return visits to an archive somewhat more challenging. But the idea was originally proposed to me, in fact, by the head of Permanent Black Publishing House in Delhi, Rukun Advani, who asked me to put together a set of my essays for publication in India, and the book has been co-published with Permanent Black. And in a way, I credit him with the original idea. Of course, he came to the idea having put together a number of volumes, first in his life at Oxford University Press and then at Permanent Black, of writings of historians and others whose work has certainly participated in some of the major debates of our time. And providing retrospectives of this work. Most recently, he had asked my Columbia colleague, Partho Chatterjee, to put together a group of his essays and to frame them in relationship to the times and context in which he wrote them. And then he asked, in an interesting variation of what happens with these books sometimes, another colleague to write the introduction, a kind of critical introduction to reflect on Partho's work in the context of her own work. This is Nivedita Menon. So I think it was out of that experience that Rukun came to me and asked me to do this. To return to where I started, I had taken on some major administrative roles, first at Columbia and then here at Berkeley. And so I had, in a way, begun to think back on my work in a way that one doesn't so much when one is carrying forward and doing a new project. I had been finishing up when this idea first arose, a book on the British in India in the late 18th century, the book called The Scandal of Empire. And I had also been then beginning a new project on the relationship between the Office of Strategic Services during World War II and the rise of area studies in the United States, and in particular the rise of South Asian studies. But I realized that was going to be a project that would only be completed once I had time to really spend extensive periods of time in archives, including in the National Archives in Washington, given the fact that I had never, as a historian of India working in Britain and India, never worked in U.S. archives. But I found that was a kind of framing device for the book, since in a way my own work reflected and certainly spoke to and was interwoven with a great deal of the period of time and many of the issues that were dominant in the history of area studies in the U.S. around South Asia. So that seemed to me to be a kind of frame. I could begin with some of my early work that came out of a graduate program at the University of Chicago, in which I trained as an historian, but I trained with an anthropologist and in the context of an area studies group that included Sanskritists and political scientists. Moved on to get jobs in history departments, but always with a kind of cross-disciplinary sensibility, and then at some point with cross-disciplinary appointments, and thus brought with me the kind of interdisciplinary inheritance of various studies into thinking about my work in graduate training in particular, as well as teaching across the board in a range of American colleges and universities. And so I thought I could position my work in relationship to area studies writ large, as well as to movements in interdisciplinary studies more specifically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wonderful, thank you. It's nice that you're talking a little bit about that, thinking about moving and working in American archive. With a wonderful frank admission that you have, I think, in the beginning of chapter one, your first ever time in an archive as a graduate student, which has a wonderful line that you say that your first thing you thought when you went there was that you panicked and thought about trying to find the nearest pub, but you didn't try and find the pub, you stayed, and you said what you had was basically a transformative experience in the archive. So I was wondering, could you please talk us through your very first experience in the archive, and this was a colonial archive, and how this came to change the way that you understood the idea of archives in themselves?
Right. Well, I think I did actually find the pub, but I did, just to be... Okay. In the interest of full disclosure, it wasn't hard to find the pub, since everybody who I got to know in the archive would go to the pub both for lunch and sometimes for drinks after closing. That is to say, the closing of the archive. And there were quite a number of pubs in the Cut, which is where the India Office Library was then located. But what I do try to reflect about a little more seriously is the extent to which going to an archive was a very daunting experience, to say the least. I'd been schooled in a way in the kind of interdisciplinary area studies, Chicago theoretical context that I did my graduate work in, to think about a project independent of archives. Not that we didn't always think about sources, but rather at the time, certainly under the spell of what was called ethnosociology in Chicago, we're thinking about how to get to the heart of fundamental epistemological understandings of South Asian cultural categories, understandings, and frames. And in constituting that as the object of knowledge, we were strangely inattentive in a way to the sources that would allow us to write any kind of history when we actually got to an archive and did what historians have to do, which is to, of course, plumb that archive, master a part of it, and use it in responsible ways to build evidence and then arguments. So in a way, what I begin by telling in that piece that I wrote some years ago for a conference actually on Braudel and his historical influence was the story of my own arrival story in an archive where I encountered the need, in effect, to do an ethnography of the archive itself. And to come to understand both the categories that were archival categories, hardly, as it were, South Asian categories of knowledge, but archival categories that had to do with institutions, with institutional histories, with the careers and lives and imperatives and ambitions of colonial servants who both occupied the offices and in a way, through their work, reified the institutional channels and corridors that made up the ultimately the departments and the entire infrastructure, as it were, of the colonial archive. The story I tell, though, also has a number of ways of looking at the archive from the point of view of other kinds of archives. So I go back to the first paper I wrote, which I actually published before going to the archive in the Indian Economic and Social History Review. And this was a paper I did on the Pallavas and Pallava kingship on the basis of epigraphical evidence that had been published and sat in the library in Chicago, and which was, of course, interesting for me, not only because it allowed me to think through ideas of sovereignty in the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th centuries, but also brought me to encounter a very different kind of archival repository. And in this instance, an archive that was really quite literally monumental. That is to say, an archive of sources that had been transcribed off of the walls and temple complexes of South India, which were themselves part of the monumental building that featured so prominently in the architecture, the built architecture of the time, and which reflected the importance of the temple, the importance of certain kinds of genealogical relationships to religious gods and figures. And the ways in which, in effect, the history of sovereignty in India was a history of was a history that that had to do with forms of authority that were hardly, strictly speaking, political. But in the context of thinking about the temple complex as an archive, I was also reading Foucault and the Archaeology of Knowledge and thinking about the monumental conditions of sources and histories. And as such, was able to try to link that early historiographical exercise with the problem more generally of the archive, and then trying to frame the encounter with the archive as an effort to both engage it on its own terms, but then to historicize it in ways that could become part of the larger enterprise that was ultimately about figuring out a set of colonial forms of knowledge in relationship to South Asian forms of knowledge. So, you know, it wasn't just a kind of methodological exercise. It was actually, for me, in a way, the beginning of my own scholarly engagement with questions around the way in which you can know anything about the past and how the frames of knowledge change across history in relationship to the histories one is writing, and therefore the kind of reflexive implication of one's own work within the larger set of questions that one is asking and historical issues one is trying to grapple with.
Wonderful, thank you very much. It really is a fascinating discussion in this section of the book. But now I'd like to move on to the following section, and this includes, I think I'm right in saying, either your first attempt at putting down the ideas or very early attempt of Casts of Mind, which is maybe the book or the argument for which you're most widely known. At least when people ask me, oh, who's on the podcast this week, and I said, oh, Nicholas Dirks, they said, oh, Casts of Mind. So my two-part question for this is, the first is, for those unfamiliar with your argument, could you just very briefly tell us its main thesis? And I was wondering if you could reflect a little bit on the debates around it in the years since you've been published, because this goes back to my question at the very beginning, when you put it again in this collection of works, how did it feel again, or did you rethink anything as you read it again for this collection?
Right. Okay. Thanks. Well, you know, again, to just make the segue from what I was saying before to answering your question, the two kinds of archives that I found most important from my first work, The Hollow Crown, were a set of land records on the one hand that were composed, compiled, and maintained within a princely state in South India, although they followed a lot of colonial categories, but also then an archive that was a collection of materials put together by a Scottish surveyor in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, Colin Mackenzie, that contained manuscripts, temple rubbings, maps, survey documents, and many, many other things of a sort that that had an only uncertain relationship to the colonial archive as such. And in fact, the colonial archive struggled to know what to do with this body of material throughout its own career. And in using these records, of course, was writing at the time about sovereignty, which was a continuation of an interest that I began, as I just said, in my first paper on the Pallavas and then the Cholas. But I came, of course, to think about what the role of caste in all of this was. The time I spent in graduate school was the time when the work of Louis Dumont was being ventilated around the American Academy, both within the specific South Asia fields, but also more generally, given his particular form of structuralism and the importance of first structuralism and then post-structuralism for rethinking historical and anthropological ideas of just about everything, including, of course, India. And of course, caste had been important in my earlier thinking about India, particularly through the anti-Brahmin, non-Brahmin movements of South India. So in looking at the Mackenzie materials and looking at the land records, I focused on trying to think through what the role of caste was in all of this, and how much did it really resemble either what I knew about caste politics in the 20th century, on the one hand, or the kind of dharma-shastric ideas of caste as they had been compiled in Manu, and then, of course, translated by Bühler and used by Western scholars and, for that matter, Indian scholars to construct the kind of ideal image of what caste was, or at least the grammars and rules that generated the relationship between the formal textual statements and the lived political realities. And what I discovered, of course, and I write about this in my first paper called Caste of Mind, what I discovered was that there was really very little about caste in that archive at all. People sometimes had names that looked like caste names, but they had those names along with a lot of other names. And there were places, and there were families, and there were political relationships, and there were offices and positions, all of which seemed at some level almost interchangeable with caste names. And of course, not only were they interchangeable, it turned out, of course, there were caste names that came out of places, that came out of offices, that came out of even feudal positions in the princely state I'd been working on. And which suggested that caste was a much more permeable, much more a system much more reflective of political, economic, and social conditions than it was solely something that however you would construct the genealogy, connected back to a religious dharmic shastric kind of depiction of caste society. And of course, I was well familiar at the time with the work of my advisor, Bernard Cohn, who had written about the colonial census and had suggested in his work that that ideas of caste were imposed through the census and through other forms of administrative instrumentality. But again, without any sense of what came before, and so I was struck by the discordance between caste that seemed to be reflected in the archival reality I was looking at for the 18th and early 19th, for that matter, mid 19th century, and what came to be both caste as it emerged in colonial documents, and then forms of writing, knowledge, and even colonial anthropology, as well, of course, with the debates around caste that were taking place vis-a-vis Dumont and another Chicago professor at the time, McKim Marriott, who was teaming up with Ronald Inden as well, and so I just basically decided to follow an instinct that there was a major disconnect between caste as I found it and caste as it became. Now, when I wrote the book Caste of Mind, I put together a lot of different material, including material from the Mackenzie Collection, including some of my work on 17th and 18th century South India. But I took on the question of the colonial census and went and looked in great detail at the way in which caste developed across the census. I looked at the work of Edgar Thurston in South India and H.H. Risley in Bengal. I then connected the story of caste at the end of the book with the role of caste first in the developing politics of India in the early 20th century, and then with the rise of nationalism, and looked at debates around caste with Ambedkar and Gandhi and Periyar, or even Ramaswamy Nayak, who was such an important figure in the South and the initial leader of the anti-Brahmin movement. And in all of these kinds of domains, decided to propose the larger argument that caste as we had come to know it had actually developed in a very striking way out of the colonial encounter, and indeed through the colonial encounter, through in the sense that it was the kind of process that Cohn had identified that actually was productive of very different kinds of lived realities around caste and lived realities that then, in their own way, sat sometimes uncomfortably with the rise of nationalism, which led, of course, to many of the debates of the 20th century. And for that matter, those are debates that sometimes continue to the present day. Now, in the reception of the book, of course, the central argument was condensed and distilled, and I was seen as arguing that the British had invented caste in India, which is something I actually specifically did not say, or rather put in terms saying that I was not writing about an invention. This was, of course, a few years after Hobsbawm and Ranger had made their argument around the invention of tradition. But, you know, of course, I had used in previous essays words like invention and imaginary and construction, and these were things that were part of trying to understand how historical categories could be imposed by states, by colonial regimes, and indeed by a range of forces that that were not themselves in some sense organic. And I was influenced by that literature. I was influenced by the work of Foucault, among others. I mean, in a way, I saw Foucault as a descendant, not so much of Nietzsche, but of Max Weber. And it was always Weber in some sense in the back of my mind, although I argued very much against, of course, the way in which he constituted India as a place and a type for his comparative sociology. But having said that, you know, my book got sort of cast, as it were, in the kind of context of the colonial construction of knowledge. And it got seen as, I think, increasingly an argument of a very top-down relationship, an argument about a colonial agency trumping Indian agency, and an argument about the role of empire being almost overdetermining in relationship to India's own capacity, not just perhaps to represent itself, but to be a major part of the story. Now, given that reception, I became concerned that the fact that I had spent, you know, a good deal of time and written many, many pages about things organic, about a small princely state, about villages and feudal warlords in parts of South India, using Tamil texts and for that matter, a great deal of ethnography done in Tamil, that a lot of that got lost in the reception of Caste of Mind, and that people were assuming somehow I was just going and reading British sources and accepting British representations of their own role and writing a book that eschewed and occluded Indian agency, and I thought one way to respond to that was by putting my work on caste in a broader context. So indeed, I thought that a book of essays that situated the caste argument, as it were, with work I did on quite a number of other things, including work on hook swinging, including work on local rituals, including some prefatory discussion of what I'd done with the Mackenzie Collection and in The Hollow Crown, could better frame the way in which the argument of caste of mind had been received.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think it really does work very well like that. I mean, when I, of course, you know, when people are students of South Asian studies, you read Caste of Mind with all of the debates around it. Nowadays, it's how you approach it. And so it was years ago when I first came across it. And then now when you read it in the book as one chapter of many, you're reading it out of that sort of hubbub. And it really, and this sort of the clarity of the argument there really comes through. This is why I really That's why I asked the question, because I really liked the way it fitted in with the chapters in this section. But now let's move on to the next section. This is a section called Empire. And I think it's the first chapter in this, which is a really fascinating chapter called Imperial Sovereignty. And so my question in regards to this is, I was wondering, could you please tell us the ways in which, it's your argument here, the ways in which the British Empire's actions in India challenged the prevailing notions of sovereignty at the time?
Right. So, yeah. Thanks. Well, I'm pleased to hear your sense of the essays having worked in some of the ways that I hoped. And you know, the section on empire, of course, reflects work that I did in the third book I wrote, The Scandal of Empire. But it does take an essay that I published in a different context on imperial sovereignty. And frames it in relationship to debates that are taking place both in India and in Europe, and of course ends up featuring in particular the role of Edmund Burke in that set of discussions. And I use Burke both to engage some of the questions that were circulating around British India in the late 18th century or middle to late 18th century. As well as to reframe, you know, some of the kinds of debates in political theory around the role of social contract theory in particular, to rethink the role that the debates in India played in the rise of certain kinds of conventions and in the understanding of sovereignty in England, in Great Britain, and for that matter in Europe more generally. So I take the kind of question of whether Mughal authority in 18th century India was de facto or de jure, as it was put by Clive, and refract that through the kinds of questions that Burke was raising, first in fact in some of the parliamentary hearings around corruption, and then in the prosecution of Warren Hastings in the impeachment trial, to think through what is happening to sovereignty in India and in its imperial relationship, and I think about it of course too by tagging on two other kinds of moments that I didn't write about at all in the book, both of which were things that I would have written much more about, perhaps written on, gone on to write about as books had I not taken an administrative turn. The first, of course, was the whole set of events around the so-called mutiny or Great Rebellion, and the trial. I don't know if I actually. I'm just trying to remember if I put that in this essay or if I put this in a later essay. I don't actually, in the one that you're asking about, I'm sorry, in Imperial Sovereignty.
You talk about, I read all the chapters, so it's messed my head as well.
Yeah, forgive me, but be that as it may, I mean, there are three different discussions there. The first really, takes Burke's contribution to European debates and features that. The second looks at something else Burke was involved in, and that is the controversy over the debts of the Nawab of Arcot. And effectively traces genealogy for the financial crisis of 2008-2009 back to what was going on in South India in the late 1760s, and then I go on to talk about questions of empire more generally and link the story of sovereignty to the trial of Bahadur Shah in 1858, and then the Red Fort trial. That takes place just after World War II. And I look at the changing meanings, contexts, nuances, and trajectories of sovereignty. And of course, this returns me to the interest I had back in the beginning when I was working on the Pallavas, obviously in a very different context. But again, my interest as a scholar has always been more about questions of sovereignty than about questions of caste. And so I did want that to frame the excerpts from the cast of mind moment as well. But I throughout all of this found Burke an incredibly productive figure. And just to go back to Burke in the 18th century, he was involved even in the life of the Nawab of Arcot through William Burke, who was a cousin of his, and who worked for a while in the court of the Raja of Tanjore, who was being beaten up by the Nawab of Arcot. And it was in part the debate between those who were serving in the court of the Nawab and those who were serving in the court of the Raja that first made for a great deal of writing about questions of sovereignty in India outside of the specific context of the Mughal Empire. And it was very interesting for me because this meant revisiting a set of books that I'd found when I was in Madras doing my dissertation back in 1975 in the Connemara Library, which I had no idea how to read. I mean, it was a whole shelf of arguments about either the glorious run of the East India Company or the huge abuses of the East India Company. But it didn't have to do with Bengal. It didn't have to do with Warren Hastings. It had to do with George Pigott and the Nawab and the Raja of Tanjore. And a whole set of characters in Madras, all of whom had very important political lives in Britain as well. It turned out that up to 12 members of parliament were funded by the Nawab of Arcot and were funded indeed to do things like advocate for the extension of credit, of lines of credit for the Nawab, to protect a complicated structure of indebtedness that everyone was using to get rich on. And it did indeed sound a lot like credit default swaps in Michael Lewis's The Big Short, which I had not read, of course, at the time, but which I had read before writing this essay that was out of the work I did for the Scandal of Empire book, and which made me think again of how one can use history to rethink the present. But that was a point in my life where I was going back in a way to thinking about the role of British in India, not from the point of view of colonial knowledge, and not even from the point of view as I began this work with the hope that I could simply bracket out the colonial presence in India to get down into the indigenous meanings of things. But even with the idea that, in fact, having spent all this time working on empire, it would be useful to think about these questions, even questions that were strictly questions in British history, from the point of view of my experience working in India. And I think, you know, these kinds of global comparative historical frames, which take place within departments of history. I mean, I just, before this podcast, in fact, had a defense with a student here at Berkeley in the history department. And it was a wonderful exchange with a British historian, another South Asian historian, and an anthropologist. And the kinds of discussions that take place there are discussions that don't always surface in the way in which we write our histories. And so in a way, I was trying, by bringing together questions of sovereignty in India and questions of sovereignty in England and Europe, trying to reflect that in how I was imagining my own scholarly contribution.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thanks for that. Now let's move on to the fourth section, and this, we're changing focus a little bit, and this is changing focus a little bit in your, I suppose, in your life as well. And the chapter I'd like to ask about in this section is when you reflect upon the future and past of South Asian studies in the USA. I mean, you touched on this a little bit earlier, as you also do in the introduction. But I was wondering, Keir, could you reflect for us a little bit on the history and the current state of South Asian studies?
Right. Well, I was asked to do a paper on South Asian studies. This was in the late 1990s for a conference in area studies that was convened by the Social Science Research Council and David Zanthin. So I was approached to do this out of the blue, and thought it was would be an interesting thing to take on. And the essay itself was supposed to be somewhat impressionistic. It wasn't supposed to be a complete survey of the field, but a kind of personal reflection about it. Of course, as an historian, I began going back and looking at some of the early work in fact, even of the Social Science Research Council in the U.S., and realized that there would be some really interesting things that could be written about the history of the IRA studies in the U.S. And I've always been struck by how distinctive the tradition of South Asian studies has been within the United States. It's obviously, for all kinds of reasons, had important effects and great influence outside of the U.S. And of course, there's a massive circulation of students and scholars that takes place, and the U.S. has occupied a kind of the kind of role of the metropole in many ways through the ways in which the universities have organized a great deal of research and also the training and teaching of these fields. But by the same token, South Asian studies in the U.S. is a very specifically, very profoundly American thing. And the more I read about this, the more I realized how much the things that that I was trained in and in relationship to came out of the U.S. experience of World War II, which of course happened before I was born, and which I never really connected very directly to any of the things that I was studying or thinking about. So having that realization sort of early on in writing that paper, of course, connected my work on the colonial sociology of knowledge to my own sociology of knowledge. And I began to think more broadly about writing something on the American sociology of knowledge vis-a-vis South Asia. So the South Asian studies piece was the first of several. It did actually, towards the end, become a way of trying to think through the internationalization of area studies, and also some of the stresses and strains that globalization had been putting on the whole area studies model. But it was also you know, the sort of first dip in the water around thinking through, as I just put it, the American sociology of knowledge around South Asia. And so after I finished doing that paper, I went on to begin research, and I did allude to this earlier, on the role of the Office of Strategic Services. And there's a lecture, there's a chapter in the book that came out of a couple of lectures, and it's really based on the latest version of that lecture I gave that I call Scholars and Spies, which of course dresses up a little bit what was going on, since most of the people working on India for the Office of Strategic Services were not spies at all, but they were sitting in a boring set of bureaucratic carrels in Washington during the war, thinking about the issues that the U.S. would have to confront, both in the world theater that the war covered, but also potentially in the aftermath of the war, should the U.S. be victorious. And it was remarkable to realize in the context of that how many scholars, not just in my own world of area studies, but in fact in the larger world of history and anthropology, came out of the OSS. I mean, just extraordinary stories. I realized that Herbert Marcuse worked for the OSS and wrote a series of papers on the nature of fascist society. Of course, the recommendations he made, which were to cater to the labor movement, were not necessarily well received, particularly by the Truman administration. But he sat next to Hayo Holborn, a man who became a major historian of Germany at Yale for many years. And here at Berkeley, I'll be honoring his daughter, Hannah Holborn Gray, on Wednesday night this week for getting the Clark Kerr Award. She went on both to become a major historian of Renaissance political theory, but then also the president of the University of Chicago. So I everywhere I look, I see the influence of the OSS. There were seven presidents of the American Historical Association who worked during the war in the OSS. But the figure for South Asia who was most important was W. Norman Brown, who was a professor of Sanskrit at the University of Pennsylvania. He had been teaching Sanskrit for quite a number of years at Penn before the war. He was recruited to work in what was called the Research and Analysis Branch of the OSS. And he set up what in effect became the India Desk in Washington, and brought a number of young scholars to work with him. After the war, he went back to Penn, and he took almost all of the scholars who he had hired during the war back to Penn with him to create the first Department of South Asian Studies. And so literally, the creation of South Asian Studies came right out of that kind of effort in the war, and I didn't have to even make a broader argument about it. But in a curious way, it had two major effects on the American Academy. The first, of course, the creation of a sense of need to study the world, and the world had been very poorly represented in the curricula and in the constitution of faculties across U.S. universities before the war. And the second was in creating the basis of interdisciplinary studies, and they were interdisciplinary because during the war effort, there was a felt need for strategic knowledge, and strategic knowledge was not the same as the knowledge of economists and political scientists and sociologists and anthropologists and historians. They had to work together. And so I found that a very interesting genealogy of interdisciplinary studies, a little bit less flattering, perhaps, than I would have previously liked to think, but one nevertheless that had a specifically American genealogy. And so in a way, this work has been reflexive in that sense of connecting some of the ways in which I've done my own work, and I see my own work, of course, as part of a much larger field of historical thinking and writing, with that particular history, and taking to heart some of the kinds of statements that had been occasionally made in response to earlier books I'd written, that all these Americans who were talking about everything from Orientalism to imperialism didn't take on the question of their own history and their own relationship to these things. And I decided, well, maybe we should.
I mean, it's nice, and especially when I saw the table of contents in the very beginning, I was thinking, how is this all going to fit together? But exactly when you do start to reflect upon your own position as an American scholar and the construction of American knowledge, then the book ties together wonderfully at the end. So I realize we're running a little bit short of time. So I just wondered if there's anything that you would like to flag up that I've missed in my questions that you would like to highlight for the listeners at home.
Well, only to say that as I look back at the book, in fact, in thinking through this, what I might say in this discussion, I did recognize that there are some framing essays, both reflected in my introduction and also in the last few chapters of the book, that aren't specifically about India or South Asian studies, and talk about the university more generally. And they might sit somewhat oddly in the book, as it might be read certainly by scholars of South Asia. And yet, that's where the autobiography becomes the link, not only in the way in which I ultimately come back to questions of South Asian studies and how I use my own life as a way to introduce that into my other writing and work, and that of many, many other colleagues, of course, in the field. But also to think through the role of the university itself. And of course, in this context, it's the American university, which in an age of globalization, of course, is now being pressed to be global in all kinds of ways, some of them real and some just symbolic or rhetorical. But which looked at, I think, somewhat more broadly, can allow us to take the university as perhaps the most successful institution in the global age, in the sense in which it does indeed genuinely construct the opportunity for real exchange, for real dialogue, for genuine collaboration and cooperation across national and other borders. And so I get a little bit maudlin towards the end of the book in talking about the importance of the university, the importance of remembering that the kinds of things we do as scholars are wonderfully supported and powerfully protected within the space of the university, however political that space is. And perhaps that might explain why it is I've taken a little detour to do some administrative work from my scholarly work, and ask indulgence from my colleagues for having done so.
Wonderful, thank you. And my very last question, you've alluded a little bit to your current research interests, but I was wondering if you could tell us, is there something on the horizon? What are your future plans in terms of more scholarly work?
Well, I do plan to go back to the war, to the OSS, and I actually would like to write a book about the kind of ways in which the work that was done in Washington did configure a different kind of intellectual culture that effectively took on the question of the U.S. role in the world after World War II, and it was a sense of the U.S. that was interestingly very anti-British, very anti-colonial, but of course that sought a different way of having influence across the world. You know, however much it was influenced by its own understanding of British colonial history or British imperial history, was, of course, treading a new imperial kind of set of relationships at the same time. So I think there's, you know, there are a number of other things that have been written in these in this area. Of course, I wouldn't be the first, but I think it would be something that that will be the first thing I'll return to when I get a little chance to go back to the archive.
Wonderful, and that's a wonderful way for us to finish. So thanks again for coming on, and thanks again for your wonderful book.
Ian, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Thanks so much for downloading the New Books in South Asian Studies podcast. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Today we've been talking about Autobiography of an Archive by Nicholas B. Dirt. Really was a great read. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation, and I hope you'll tune in again next time. Ta-ra!